Okay, is everybody back?
Yep.
Huh?
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so we'll start the conversation by asking if there are any announcements.
Hey, Tamara, this is Frank Niepold. Should we announce what happened yesterday? I imagine most people
why don't you go ahead, Frank? You can start, and those of us that were there can pipe in also.
Well, so I mean, it was very gratifying to actually have the event happen. So we're talking about the Champions of Change for Climate Education and Literacy as part of the White House expansion of the Climate Action Plan for the President to include education, which is a stunning thing by itself. And then there was a large gathering of leaders of the climate and education community at the White House yesterday from 1 to almost 7 o'clock in the night, celebrating 8 individuals from different fields around the country, national park rangers, ACE educators, and so on. David Lustig, who's a member of the community, and others who are also part of our community.
It was
were,
also
were
one
not
college
paid.
Student. One of them was
yep.
a college student.
Yep. And, and the room was filled with students from the Alliance for Climate Education, from the Green Schools, Green Ribbon Schools. It was, about 200 people in total. High officials in the Obama administration spoke, including the science advisor to the president, the chief technology officer, who is really spectacular, Meg, what's her name?
Which one?
The chief technology officer. She was the one that ended the remarks.
Oh, wait,
remarks.
I have that right here. The chief technology officer, Megan Smith.
United States
technology officer. And then Brian Deese, deputy director of OMB, who said that he was going to be taking over for, what's his name?
Podesta. John Podesta.
Podesta, yes.
The senior advisor to the president on climate and energy. So these are no small things, and they were very much valuing what we do as a community and seeing it as a very strong contribution to the efforts to address climate change and our energy challenges. And that's no small feat by itself. And on top of that, there were 3 breakout sessions, one focused on educators, one focused on students, and one focused on the informal and place-based education work afterward with the people who came with the nominees or the recipients of that acknowledgement, and then leaders. And so other leaders in the climate and energy literacy awareness, Energy Awareness Network, sorry, I botched that, were there. Tamara and Susan Burr-Sullivan were in there with me and others in the educator one. And, it was very gratifying to have that happen. So, there's a lot of substance that we don't have time to get into now, but, it was a big deal. So
okay, and two of the other people. We were at the educators roundtable, and Joe Handelman, who's associate director for science at OSCP, and Alice Paul, who is senior advisor for preparedness and resilience for the national security staff, was there. So they were really there to listen to us, and which was very impressive. And I talked to Laura Petras at the end, who was a person that organized all of this. From OSCP, and she said that she had suggested these roundtables, that this was something that was new, but she said she couldn't pass up the opportunity to really take advantage of the fact that there was so much expertise there for those 4 or 5 hours. So it was a really special event. And I did send out in the email, there was the part of the event that was honoring the 8 awardees, there were 2 panels, one focused on formal education and one more focused on engaging citizens and communities. And there's a YouTube video of the first one, but I couldn't find the second one, so I don't know why. But anyway, I put that in the email, the link to that, if people are interested in seeing it. The other thing that struck me is that they did ask over and over again what the federal government could do to help, and obviously funding, but that's not going to happen. That was kind of unsaid. Like, we really need to talk about sort of in a broader sense. And I think that there are, a lot of thinking has to be done around that, because I did talk to Holdren briefly about it at the end during the reception, and he seemed to think that the federal government was really quickly respond to things, and he sort of started naming things that were happening. But I think that there's a lot, once there's momentum behind something, but when you're actually asking them to do something you haven't done before, I think it's like moving a ship. It's really slow. So I think a lot of thinking has to go behind that, conversation has to go behind that.
Tamara, just one thing on that funding point, though. I think there's a challenge in the community that we have not dealt with, and perhaps we are well-positioned to talk about that. Not now, obviously, but is the funding model that, as great as it was in 2008, and that led to the tri-agency initiative and the $120+ million that went into our community, those were all innovation projects. Even the CSEP Phase 2s at, $6 million over 5 years is really a small project in the grand scheme of things. And I think that we've all struggled with the funding, fits and starts and small amount of money over multiple years once you take into overhead. I think we still have an articulation of what effective funding, whether it's federal or non-federal, to take on the challenge that we are positioned to help with. I don't think we've got I don't think anybody has a good working funding model for this. And I think that developing one at some level by whomever is a still outstanding need, because another $1 million over 3 years that isn't going to work.
I think part of our problem is that a lot of us are very used to more of the model of this is what the solicitation has. Now, what can you do for this amount of money instead of addressing, well, this is what needs to happen and how much will it cost?
So I think the latter is there's still a discussion somewhere down the road. If it could be done through an official channel or a reputable channel, that can be taken into federal input without, necessarily recommending to any particular one agency, I think it's still a valuable space. Because we talked about scale as a big challenge in our conversations. How do we scale these initiatives? And funding is the key part of that conversation. That showed up multiple times. But I don't want to take too much time from Don's time.
Yeah. Well, this is Bonnie. I do want to mention one other piece. We did talk about the F word in our place-based group. And I agree, Tamara. There was a big question about what could the federal government do, and that's where the F-word funding came up. And one of the things that we requested or suggested was that they could help with providing some kind of a clearinghouse or a CMS or an LMS where all the content could live. So that was notes that was taken back, so I just want to mention that and make sure that's part of this discussion.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thank you. Anybody else who's on the phone that was there want to give your perspective?
Just a quick note about the video link that you provided, Tamara. I took a quick look at it this morning, and I think for those of us who aren't there and for those of us who work with other educators and students, it's a nice piece both to get new ideas and think about, ways to get over challenges and to gain inspiration. So I'd encourage people to use that link in programs and with participants in your program.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I was thinking, I think we're going to move forward with doing is at least for the 8th honorees. We've actually had one of the honorees who had their had his students give a presentation on the Clean Network, but to have the rest of the awardees to invite them to give presentations about their efforts on the Clean Network call. So I'm going to pursue that. Okay. Any other announcements, comments?
This is David Blackstein. I just wanted to...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that it's gone on the listserv, and I'll send it again, but the Earth Educators Rendezvous in the week of July 13th at Boulder, the deadline for abstracts is at the end of this month, and I'll just send out a reminder, but given the topic of today, there actually is going to be a plenary panel about fracking in the context of teaching about controversial issues.
Okay, great, thanks.
And Tamara, we might remind everyone to mute their phones once Dawn gets started.
Yes, that's a very good idea. It gets very noisy with a lot of people on the line, so we appreciate that.
Tamara, I forgot.
Yes?
It is kind of noisy today. One thing, if you guys can hear me, that they came out was pretty stunning for me in the Educators Workshop, which I think relates to some of the general topics that we're talking about here, was this the first time in any of the climate, energy, education, you know, earth science or system science meetings where a lot of experts across this community of about 35, 40 people resoundingly said that the focus of our educators should not be science teachers exclusively or STEM teachers.
Right.
It was all educators, art, social studies, humanities, everybody. We had one of the recipients was a physical education person doing amazing work in Florida. So I just wanted to make sure you guys heard that initial high-level point. I've never heard it said that strongly before.
Who was it that did the same,
cool.
Frank?
She was one of the honorees. I think she was Linda Anciano. I think she was the person from Florida who was honored.
You definitely get that message, Frank, by watching the one-hour video.
Yeah.
I'll set on my to-do list.
Breakout.
Okay.
Yeah, I think in the roundtable, I think I put it that we wanted systems thinking beyond the sciences, not just the sciences.
Yeah, my next book, or Ingrid and I are working on the teacher-friendly guide to climate change, and the more I think about it, the more I want to make it accessible to non-science teachers. So, and if
That's
folks
great.
Are interested in the outline on that, you know, let me know. I think I've sent it out on the list before. It's been tweaked a little since then. So we've got a detailed outline. We've written a little bit, and we're hoping to have it done by summer. But thinking about how to connect to those folks, we welcome insight. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Should I dig in?
Yeah, so let me just introduce you. So everybody knows that Dawn Dugenhaus is giving our presentation today. The link is on the site. Dawn is the Director of Teacher Programs at the Paleontological Research Institution and its Museum of the Earth in Ithaca, New York. And Dawn has been teaching at both the college and high school levels, and he's been a long-term member of the Clean Network, and he's going to be talking to us today about hydrofracking, climate change, and evolution outreach yields rules of thumb for teaching about controversial issues. So with that, Dawn, go ahead.
All right. So this is essentially what I'm going to do is the talk that I did in double time at GSA of this title and using that presentation with a couple of updates. And that draws from earlier presentations, and I know a lot of people on the call have seen some of this before, so hopefully it's interesting enough to hold your attention for another go-round. But if in terms of what I did at GSA, I pulled from earlier stuff and combined it and teased out these rules of thumb that we've come up with. Mostly I'm going to end up talking about our energy-related education, which comes from our NSF-funded work on teaching people about the Marcellus Shale, which is the gas shale in the Northeast under Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, and New York are parts of the state. Did I say New York? Was that echoing myself? Go ahead and dig in. So it's a the presentation's a complement to our book, which is there. It is done. The work is done with National Science Foundation funding, which comes with a promise not to advocate for or against hydraulic fracturing, which we think not only is a a funder required promise, but also good pedagogy, in part because learning from advocates tends to deepen convictions more than understandings, but not necessarily. It can do both at once, but it also tends to the way a lot of the advocacy work around hydraulic fracturing has gone is that it deepens convictions at both poles of a polarizing issue, and we think a non-advocacy stance makes good sense for those reasons, and also because, unlike evolution and climate change, the environmental cost-benefit analysis of hydraulic fracturing is, in spite of the way it looks in the news media, really still somewhat of an open question. It's environmental impacts are not good, but maybe less bad than other things. When we try and be unbiased, we recognize also that that's almost impossible. And somebody's got kind of a loud phone. I'm wondering if everybody's on mute. we recognize that we can't recognize our own biases. So we're grounded in reality. Hello, puppy.
Please mute your phone.
So we have a long history of dealing with controversial issues, and that might be because we think that we want people to shoot us, but really it's because these issues are tightly connected to the history of life on Earth, which is what the Paleontological Research Institution is about, is the history of life on Earth and interplay with how that affects the Earth system. And we're interested in these things because we believe they're just incredibly important for people to understand, and there's a lot of work to be done along those lines. So it's not really that we want people to shoot us. My guess is that at least half of you have heard me ask this question before. The data keeps morphing to some degree. So I'm hopeful that those of you who have seen it before know your answer, but I'm going to ask you to think about what are the two largest energy sources for electricity produced in your state, and they're there in alphabetical order. It also just so happens that the first four alphabetically are the four largest in the country, and until pretty recently, the four largest in New York. Since we've done most of this work in New York, I'm going to use New York as the example. So I want you to think about what are the two largest sources for electricity in your state and for New York State. So pretend to be a New Yorker. When I do this with an audience I can see, I ask people to raise their hands twice as I go down the list. I had thought about putting in a little Survey Monkey thing here or something, but I didn't get that done. I guess I'll ask for a shout-out from people who haven't seen me present this before. What do you think are the two largest sources of electricity, of energy for electricity generation in New York? Anybody?
Natural gas.
Natural gas, okay. What else?
Coal.
Okay.
I'd say coal.
Okay. I'll tell you what the modal answer is. The most common answers are coal and hydro. We do have The largest power plant in the state is the hydro plant at Niagara Falls, 2.4 gigawatt plant. But even though that's the largest plant, the other hydro plants in the state aren't very big. And we actually get more energy from natural gas and from nuclear than from any other source. So people typically don't know. This is what it looks like for the whole country, and we can go look at any particular state you want to look at for 2012. And we'll zoom in on the U.S. totals. So for 2012, I believe it was 42% coal, somewhere around 35% natural gas, and 22% nuclear, and then hydro, and then wind has grown enough in the last few years to actually show up on a pie graph, which is pretty cool. So that's what it looks like for the U.S. as a whole, which is a really big change in the last decade or so. If we go back to 2007 or 2008, we were getting considerably more than half of our electricity in the country from coal. New York is a different story. That's what New York looks like in 2012. I haven't seen the data for 2013 or 2014 as yet, but somebody at a meeting I was at last week said that last year, 2014 for New York State, 55% of our electricity came from natural gas. It's a huge change in not very many years. The last year, coal and wind were roughly tied. This year, wind will almost certainly produce more electricity in New York State than coal. And I'm getting a lot of noise there. If somebody else can mute, maybe. And throughout this presentation, you'll see a couple of spots where there's a little image of a shovel where you can dig deeper and get a little bit more info. So you can go back to 2009, and I think, whoops, didn't do that quite yet. And you can also look at what we're generating in the state. So there's, for October 2014, you can see the most recent data on the Energy Information Administration website. We got a lot more electricity from non-hydro renewables than we did from coal, about three or four times as much. You can also see that when we look at total consumption, we get almost twice as much energy from natural gas as from the second biggest source, which is gasoline. And for what we produced, so pay attention actually to the numbers there. So 1.26 trillion BTUs of natural gas consumed, and we do produce gas in New York State, 27.2 trillion produced in the state, which is about between 2 and 3% of the total amount that we use. So that gives us some important context about why I'm asking the question, and I think let me also note that there's a standalone version of this quiz that you can ask about any state if you follow that link. So why did I include the poll? Well, a bunch of reasons. One is that one sound piece of educational research shows that engaging relevant conceptions matters. People come into your programming with ideas about whatever it is that you're teaching about, and you want to connect to that, or they'll walk out maybe having some knowledge of what you've talked about, but in a separate mental box in their brain than what they actually use for decision making. I also raised the question of, can we make informed decisions about changes to the energy system if we don't know where we currently get our energy? And that's not a rhetorical question. I think the answer is no. I also know that most people get the question wrong, and it's fun to ask questions that people get wrong as long as you're polite about it and have a good sense of humor. So now getting towards thinking of more generalizable rules here, raising the question of, is slick water, high-volume horizontal hydraulic fracturing bad for the environment? And the answer to that is clearly yes. However, so is every other way that we generate energy on a large scale. So we want to ask Richard questions, which is a general, which starts to get at one of the general rules of thumb about teaching controversial issues is that for polarizing issues, people are very often asking a black and white question, and the reality tends to be a lot more complicated than that. So rule of thumb number one is complexify the seemingly simple. If it's a polarizing issue, think about if you can move from debate to discussion. Recognize that controversial issues are always interdisciplinary and can become more deeply understood from the systems perspective. So thinking about how to teach systems, I think, is incredibly important for controversial issues. But don't forget about the importance of the simple. In the case of an issue like hydraulic fracturing and other energy issues, a really important simple bottom line is that we need to figure out how to use a whole lot less energy than we do. So in terms of shifting from debate to discussion, that involves reframing the question. So one of the ways that we've done that related to fracking is asking not whether it's good or bad, but whether it's better or worse for the environment than what we're doing now or might reasonably do in the near future, which connects to two important questions. The one that gets asked seemingly all the time is, should we use this kind of energy? The one that doesn't get asked nearly enough is, should we use this much energy? And that points to rule of thumb number two, that evidence matters, but evidence alone is not enough. I think we can see that pretty clearly in the controversial issue that's playing out in the news right now about vaccinations. The evidence is clear and provided to lots of people, and they look right past it. And that happens in climate change. It happens in hydraulic fracturing. It happens in evolution. And I've sort of come to think that a large part of my job is trying to figure out how to help people who are unable to grasp the evidence that's in front of them. And that goes to learning about cognitive biases, including your own, to state evidence clearly and directly and identify a small number of key points, be blunt but politely so. The mathematics really, really matters in all of these issues. Evolution, we're talking about a 4.5 billion year old Earth, and life has been around for most of that time, and we have a very hard time grasping that because we've only been around in something that looks like ourselves for a couple of million years, and society's only been around for 10,000 years, and thinking about what 400 parts per million means is really hard for lots of people to grasp, and so on. So math is a part of all of these, particularly scale, and calling out logical fallacies is also something that you need to learn how to do, and there's some good resources on the Digging Deeper here for that, including the logical fallacies poster, which I think should be in every classroom in the country. And you can see there's lots of things there that you can click on for more detail. Speaking of the mathematics, it's hard to visualize what millions of gallons of water look like. This is a time-lapse video that I shot of a lock on the Champlain Canal, which is a tributary canal of the Erie Canal and up by Saratoga, New York, sort of. And what we just watched, which I'll play again here, was 2 million gallons of water filling up that lock. And it took about 5 minutes in real time, time-lapse down to 20 or 30 seconds or something like that. So when we talk about hydraulically fracturing the typical Marcellus shale well, that takes about 4 million gallons of water, about twice as much as we just saw flow through that lock. Whether that's a lot or a little depends on your perspective and where you live. It's not a little really for anybody, but it's also something that fills a lock in 5 minutes, so it's not a huge, huge amount. So also... partly looking at the mathematics and the contextualization, what comes next is looking at a comparison of energy sources, sort of using one very large power plant as a measuring stick. And so I think of this as sort of a compound statistic with a question that follows it. And looking at a very large nuclear power plant, this is the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station, which is in Ontario, about 150 miles from where I'm sitting right now and upwind from me. It's at the base of the Bruce Peninsula, which separates Lake Huron and Georgian Bay. It's 6.3 gigawatts, which makes it the largest currently operating nuclear power plant in the world. It gets its energy from uranium. This is a uranium mine in Saskatchewan, Canada. So when we look at its footprint, we have to remember that its footprint isn't just the plant itself, but also its supply chain. If we wanted to make as much energy as that does with New York State's largest power plant, we'd need to more than double the size of it. That's the hydro plant at Niagara Falls, Robert Moses Power Plant, which actually is going to be, I think, increasing in production by 20 or 25% by updating its turbines in the next few years, by being more efficient with the energy, with the water that's flowing through it. We'd need 2.5 of the largest gas-fired power plant in the state, which is almost as big as the Robert Moses plant. And this is the Ravenswood Generating Station in Queens, New York, which is increasingly getting its energy from hydrofrack wells in Pennsylvania. It's also worth noting that using this as sort of an iconic image for hydrofracking is a little problematic because this rig will probably only be there for about a week while the well is being drilled and it's removed actually before the hydraulic fracturing happens. We need 3,800 large windmills. That's about four times as many as we have in the state right now. This is the Noble Bliss Wind Park south of Rochester, or about 10 power plants equal to the state's largest coal plant, which compared to other states is not so big. And I should also note that historically, we've gotten our coal from Appalachian coal, but it's now increasingly coming from out west because that's lower sulfur. So fixing one environmental problem to bring another. Or we need about 68 square miles of photovoltaic. This is about 10 miles from my house. It is now the second largest photovoltaic array in upstate New York at the University of Buffalo, and they call it the Solar Strand for reasons you can see from its layout. It's about a quarter of a mile long and about as wide as a two-lane or a four-lane highway. If we wanted to extend that to make it the same generating capacity as the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station, we'd need to extend it from Buffalo to Phoenix, Arizona. So that's got some environmental impact with it as well. So the question then is, which of those is worse for the environment? They're all pretty horrible. I like to say I've been rubbing my nose in the energy system for the last several years, and it all stinks. So trying to sort that out complexifies our question, but also points to that bottom line simplification of using a lot less energy, and brings us, maybe I need a better segue here, but part of what needs to happen when you're teaching about controversial issues is to be nice, but know that there are limits. Part of being nice means knowing your audience, because different audiences have different definitions of nice. It's really, really important to remember that for the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part, people aren't lying. People believe the things that they're saying, even if there's ample scientific evidence that they're wrong. They aren't lying. They are just believe something that's not true. As I said at the outset, advocacy can deepen convictions more than understanding. It's also really important not to let the bastards get you down, and I'll admit that lately I've been pretty cranky about how some of this goes, and I should take my own advice on that, but it's hard. So have a support system. I'm going to skip that. That idea of being nice is incredibly important when you stop and process what goes on in a lot of discussions around controversial issues. includes people calling one another greedy, evil, or stupid. And if you think about that as a communication strategy or a way to get someone to change their mind, and if you think of people trying that on you, you know from your own experience that it doesn't work. If someone is calling someone else stupid, the other person is very unlikely to go, oh, you're right, I am an idiot. And it does happen. But for the most part, you got to figure out how to be nice. I've got embedded here this great John Cleese talking about stupidity in a couple of different presentations of what it looks like online. If you just go to YouTube, you get John Cleese on stupidity. Daily Chaos titled it John Cleese on Fox News Stupidity. And from my own, you know, anecdotal evidence, I posted this both ways on my Facebook line. People got really, really ticked off about this one and laughed at this one. Even though the content's exactly the same, he actually only mentions Fox News almost in passing in the last few seconds of the video, and the whole thing is very funny and very true and well-grounded, and it's an explanation of the Dunning-Kruger effect, and if you don't know what that is, you should watch the video after we're done. Maybe the most important rule of thumb is that persistence matters. We know that people do change their minds on things that matter. If you don't believe that, there's two words, gay marriage. People do change their minds on things that matter. If you're persistent and sort of a piling on of evidence that follows the other rules and importantly focuses on a few key ideas generally, can bring beliefs to a tipping point, and it doesn't necessarily, but it might. And I think it's very, very helpful to reflect on big changes in your own beliefs. Most of us have changed our minds about things that matter. I was, for example, raised in one religion that I am no longer a party to, more or less. And processing how that changed took place with yourself can help you think about how other people's minds change as well.
Can I ask you a question, or do you prefer not?
Sure. Yeah, go right ahead.
This is Joe Levine, and I found that in working with teachers, it's very important when talking about evolution to separate the notion, the concept of scientific understanding from the concept of belief, loosely defined. So, and I saw in that previous place, you were using belief a lot when it came to scientific issues. I just wondered about that.
Yeah, and we've thought about that a lot, and I've talked about that a lot, and I have I've used belief more lately, rightly or wrongly. It's certainly the common wisdom that belief and acceptance are should be talked about. We should distinguish, as science educators, distinguish between belief and acceptance of the scientific understanding. I don't think any of that talk is actually grounded in cognitive differences in what's going on inside people's heads. I need to do some more digging on that. I know it's almost blasphemous to talk about belief. But I also think that we're making that linguistic distinction, which may or may not be a cognitive distinction, and I think it's very much worth talking about. So there's some thoughts on that, and I'm rule number five is the last rule, so we'll just go through this and then go into discussion. So rule number five is to use one's place in the world as a starting point. We're actually, you know, speaking of evolution, we're working on evolution in your backyard was the topic of our Darwin Days, one of our Darwin Days lectures this week at the museum, and looking for how it plays out where you are, and you can do the same with climate change, and you can do the same with energy Thank you very much. If you haven't looked at the Energy Information Administration's interactive map, you can see all of the large-scale energy infrastructure in the country in the interactive map. It's really phenomenal, and I really recommend clicking on that. And, you know, I started with New York State because that's where I am in terms of what we're doing in our programming related to energy. And you can do that with any of these critical or controversial issues. And I've actually rephrased that. I should note, too, that there's coming out very, very soon. I think maybe it's already available online. The current issue of NAGTs in the Trenches has a slightly more polished version of these rules of thumb included in it. And I think that's where I end. Oh, and there's a one-page summary here, which I need to make those edits that I made in the in the Trenches article. And sorry that I'm sort of stumbling. The static is static my brain a little bit.
Sorry, said that.
<here we go>. Yeah. So, questions, comments. If you want to talk more about belief versus acceptance, I'm certainly game to dig into that.
Well, if nobody else, yeah, I would go further into that, because let me explain to you what I was able to determine works, because I work with teachers, as you probably do at the museum, not just as a one-off, but you then see them again, and you get to ask them whether the advice you gave them worked or not. And what I was able to tell teachers is that if a parent comes into them and says, what are you trying to get my kid to believe in this evolution stuff for? If you separate, and if you genuinely mean it, if you genuinely say, I don't believe in evolution at all, I understand and accept the scientific evidence for evolution. Belief is something else. You know, I mean, I often use, as a lot of other people do, people, if they ask me if I believe in gravity, I say, no. But I understand and accept the predictions of gravitational theory and would generally tend to take them into account before I stepped off the roof of a tall building. And what I've gotten back from teachers is that distinction really works for them. That it helps you, not all the time, not everywhere, not for everyone, but that it often does work to diffuse, particularly evolution. I think it's less of an issue with fracking and stuff like that.
Right. It is. And that raises important questions about the differences between different controversial issues. And one of the, I think that makes very good sense for teaching about evolution, particularly in a public school setting. The there are a lot of similarities. I think these rules of thumb, which didn't mention to do with belief versus acceptance, I think cut across the different controversial issues, but not everything cuts across the different controversial issues. And one of those is, as I mentioned at the outset, is that the environmental cost-benefit analysis of fracking versus other sources of energy is still an open question. Even though it's clear that it's bad for the environment, it's not clear that it's worse than coal or tar sands oil, for example. So,
hey, Tom, this is Frank. One of the aspects of this is that there are other pieces of the puzzle that aren't put into this. When Christina Johnson, who was the Deputy Secretary of Energy in the Obama administration in the first term, for those of us who were at the Energy Education Summits before the NCSC meeting, she alluded to, you know, what it would take to hit 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050. And she said it was about $1 trillion and those who weren't there. And I asked her for the report. And the report that they did was the Strategic Technology Energy Plan in 2010, with 2010 dollars and they were able to generate an 80% reduction in electrical generation, 80% reduction in carbon emissions for that. And I asked her, what would it take now? It's cheaper. And she said, it's clearly going to be less than that. But that's 0.37 GDP, which is cheap compared to the offsets of the cost of impacts if we don't make that reduction. That's a long setup to it's hard to make these financial trade-offs if there isn't a other, business as usual is not neutral to the budget.
Right.
And so, like these other externalities have to be put into the conversation. And from an educator's perspective, I mean, I don't think we've ever, as citizens, tried to be as intentional about our energy future as we are being asked to do.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah.
So we're designing something intentionally big for these big external reasons that we've never really tried to be fully involved. I mean, policymakers and stakeholders have made these decisions kind of in an organic fashion that have led to what we have, not intentionally designing a solution at a national or state level that meets our social values. That's really different, and I think we have to appreciate that difference as we move forward. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Part of that has to do with how our energy system has changed and should change. And this gives some insight into that. It's important to understand what this graph is a graph of. And for those who aren't following me, I zoomed ahead to slide 55, which you can click and drag to if you're on the Prezi but not on following my link. And this shows the current power plant operating in the U.S. as of 2012. By capacity and initial year of operation. So if every power plant in the country was turned up full blast, this is the pie graph shows what that would look like, and the area graph shows what year that that source came online. It doesn't mean, for example, if you look back in time, that back in 1940 every power plant was a hydro plant. It means that virtually every power plant that's still online that was built in 1940 is a hydro plant. So lots of plants have retired over that time frame. So hydro plants are durable. So it does show that our infrastructure, our energy infrastructure, has changed a lot over time. It also shows that we've got a lot of capacity related to coal and natural gas. And it gives you some idea about the basics of our current infrastructure, which I think is really important to understand, as we need to use the infrastructure we have to make the infrastructure that we need. And part of the discussion about moving to a lower carbon intensity, there are people out there who believe that we can do it overnight. And because we have to use the infrastructure we have to make the infrastructure we need, we just can't do that. We don't have the infrastructure capacity right now to build renewables with renewables. So we have to build them with something else. And we need to think carefully about what that means, which is not exactly what your comment was about, but it's related to it.
A quick follow-up, Don. I mean, at some point that this... The amount of carbon in the atmosphere is the bottom line, and how we hit that target and when we hit that target. And, I mean, and if you talk to the climate community as opposed to the energy community, they say we should hit that target sooner than the energy community,
absolutely.
Right? Because they're like the risks that you don't understand these risks that you're playing with, which I think is another piece of that whole risk analysis space.
Mm-hmm.
And the climate community are saying go much faster than what their, the energy community thinks is feasible. So, it's a really challenging thing for humanity to try and wrestle this forward. But what gives me great promise is that we have education where you have time to skillfully and carefully go through stuff, as opposed to, you know, media or, you know, other modalities where you really don't have time and skill built.
Right.
That's what gives
And I continue to think the thing that we can do the fastest is use less energy. And some of that is about building new infrastructure, but some of it is using the infrastructure we have in different ways than we have them. And I, as an example of that, I am part of the 2% in Erie County, New York, who goes to work without leaving the home. I walk downstairs and I turn on my computer. There's a really interesting interactive map of the U.S. that shows how people get to work. I'll send out the link after the call. That shows overwhelmingly people drive by themselves in a car to work. And the energy impact of that is humongous and doesn't require new technologies for it to change very rapidly. If we allow, if we encourage more people to telecommute, we can drop energy footprints by a lot fairly quickly without any changes in technology, other than maybe scaling up fiber optic internet. And there are lots of examples along those lines. The amount of food that we waste in the country is somewhere on the neighborhood of 40% of the food produced goes to waste, and that means all of the energy that goes into growing, irrigating, trucking, yada, 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 is all wasted for that 40% roughly of the food that we grow. So figuring out how to waste less food is also a way to figure out how to waste less energy. So lots and lots of pieces to lowering the carbon footprint, and I think the things that lead to reducing demand will get us further along more quickly than converting the infrastructure that produces the energy.
Okay, are there any other questions? Okay, well,
yeah.
We're... Go ahead.
Tamara, I've got a quick follow-up to what Don just said, if we've got a second.
Sure.
Sorry. I mean, you know, Don, what I'm hearing you say, is I completely and utterly agree. But what I think that is missing is how all of these changes, whether it's decarbonizing electricity, substitution biofuels for petroleum, modernizing transportation and transmission and distribution, you know, switching from fossil fuels to electricity, increasing efficiency and conservation. It's the combination of all of them simultaneously. It's almost like the Wilson diagram. You know, they all have to happen concurrently and fast in order to get the targets we look for.
Yep. My biggest point is that I think that we don't talk about using less nearly enough in what we talk about. All of the above in energy reduction, which is a different way to use the all of the above phrase than some others have, is really, really important. But I think we don't give enough attention to the ways that we can reduce energy demand. And I'll also send along previous energy production or energy demand estimates for decades out that typically all overshot, and I think we're still doing that. They overestimated the amount of energy that we would use 20, 30 years out, whatever.
Duly noted.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's very interesting. Thank you, Don.
Yes, Don.
Well, thank you very much, and we
excellent
will post
presentation.
The recording. Recording. Thanks a lot.
Thanks
all.